He learned it's not only, it's hard to write Shakespeare, it's even harder to tweet Shakespeare. And when he talks about how mainstream media goes from crisis to crisis to crisis, you know, they went from the Egypt crisis to the Japan crisis to the biggest crisis of all, the Charlie Sheen crisis. Our next panelist is Marcy Wheeler. She blogs as Empty Wheel at Fire Dog Lake. She exposed press corruption in her book, Anatomy of Deceit, how the Bush administration used the media to sell the Iraq War and out a spy. She live blogged the Scooter Libby trial. He's the chief of staff for Vice President Cheney. In early February, when Secretary of State Clinton was insisting that supporting Egypt's Vice President Omar Suleiman was the path to democracy, Marcy was offering a slightly different reality, blogging day after day about Suleiman as, quote, America's torturer. Marcy Wheeler.
It's really humbling to follow Sharif because, like many of you, I'm one of those kind of quintessential bloggers who sits in her pajamas in Michigan and covers what I can cover, and I was just as reliant on you for Sharif's tweets as anybody else was. So Fire Dog Lake is not big enough, nor do we have the skill sets needed to go and risk our lives and our safety and our freedom in Egypt to cover this, and so it's humbling. That said, we do and did try, and there were things that we are able to cover that I think are important to the debate. We do kind of the curation that a lot of bloggers do. I am kind of notorious for my document dumps. I go in and weed stuff out and find out how many times we tortured Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, for example. This post, which I wanted to draw your attention to, is from this morning that Shun does. She has a lot of conversations with Middle Eastern activists. She does a weekly post on this. And this also just happened last night. She had been working on Twitter with a young Bahraini woman who was documenting kind of the crackdown on Bahraini activists. And last night, her father and brother got arrested. So this is up on the front page of Fire Dog Lake right now. And at the bottom, there's a bunch of phone numbers that you can call if you're so inclined to kind of beat up on Americans who are letting Bahrain really crack down on their activists in a way that they were a little more squeamish about in the case of Egypt. And that, I think, gets to where somebody like me has an obligation to cover events in the Middle East, in North Africa, and Afghanistan. And it's there are these two stories. There's this amazing, inspiring story about activists in Egypt. And then there's a story about our responsibility as American citizens in kind of the late American empire and the degree to which the American empire has relied on Hosni Mubarak for the last generation. And therefore, we in many ways, our government in many ways has empowered that dictatorship and many others around the world. So the stories I think that we are responsible for telling, Jeff brought up Omar Suleiman. If you don't know, he is the guy who there was a detainee, Ibn Sheikh al-Libi, who was captured in Afghanistan in 2001. And the FBI was interrogating him, and then one day the CIA came up, wrapped him in duct tape, sent him on a plane to Egypt, and he was tortured personally, Suleiman. This guy that Hillary Clinton said that, you know, he's going to be our shepherd of democracy in Egypt, personally involved in the torture of this detainee. And the detainee under that torture claimed that there were ties between al-Qaeda and Iraq, and that is one of the pieces of intelligence that got us into Iraq. Suleiman also traveled to, then this detainee kind of got bopped around our secret prison system, eventually ended up back in Libya. He was Libyan originally, and in 2009, just as a lot of our torture was becoming public, and particularly the role of torture in inventing an excuse to go into the Iraq War, al-Libi was suicided, and Suleiman was actually in Libya at the time that that happened. It was very convenient that all of a sudden he died. That's one of the stories that I think we as Americans are obligated to tell and to have told in this country. Another one is the looting that Mubarak and Gaddafi and everybody else has been doing for many years. The traditional media paid some attention to the way they moved their money around in the weeks of the early uprising, and as a result were successful at getting some of it out. One of the reasons Gaddafi is being so resilient is that he's got money in Libya that he can use to pay his mercenaries. But what they didn't tell is that for, again, a generation, we sat there and watched as Mubarak took money, looted from his people, and moved the money into often British or American bank accounts. And our financial economy really relies on all of this money being dumped from the elite who are looting their people in Egypt. And gosh, you know, you think there's a relationship between the fact that we allow that to happen. And then the other thing that I think the independent media did do a good job of covering was the degree to which our neoliberal policies, the economic policies that we've been pushing down. I mean, I know there was a lot of news domestically yesterday, but did anyone see that Obama yesterday, as food prices are back historical highs, said we need to dump more money into ethanol? Anybody see that? That's a completely immoral decision, because what it's going to do is drive food prices up all around the world, and food scarcity was one of the issues that's driving this. So, I mean, those are the stories that I think we have an obligation to tell. But what we, to some degree, rely on, me sitting in my pajamas in Michigan blogging, is Mika Sifri yesterday referred to transnational media. And I think, you know, maybe with the Green Revolution in Iran, it is real that Sharif can write his tweets, and to the extent he can get them out, we can cover it in the United States, and there will be some accounting for what's going on the other side of the world. And I think, you know, those bloggers of us sitting in our pajamas are particularly reliant on it. But there's this really remarkable moment where our government is facing the end of its empire, facing the kind of beginning weakness of the empire, and their information policies, the policies on social media or on the degree to which these stories move transnationally are really interesting. And I just want to bring up four data points on this, because I think it's a testament to both how they're trying to control information here, but also some of the dangers that some of the areas where they're going to come after us. One is the story of Raymond Davis. Raymond Davis is an American who was in Pakistan, who killed two Pakistanis. His cover story was, they tried to rob me, and I was defending myself. But very quickly, the Pakistani media made it clear, and to their credit, the traditional media here in the United States made it fairly clear. He was arrested with a GPS satellite, with a phone with some very interesting pictures, with phone numbers of a bunch of people in the tribal areas in Pakistan. And, you know, it became clear this guy was not your average consular employee, which is what we were claiming he was. And in Pakistan, the mobs who were insisting that he get a trial, and the people who were holding him, were all very clearly saying he's a spy. The traditional media here in the United States knew that. They had that story. He was arrested in late January, and they sat on it because the administration went to them and said, can you sit on this? And then eventually, around February 21st, The Guardian reported it. And then the New York Times came out and said, well, gosh, you know, yeah, we had the story, but we didn't publish it. The administration told us not to. And they said that if we publish, you know, and it was sort of ridiculous, because the people who were a risk to Raymond Davis, the Pakistani mobs, the people who held him prison, Al-Qaeda and the Taliban in Pakistan and Afghanistan, all knew or were working under the assumption he was a spy. So the only people who didn't know were us, were the people who rely on the New York Times for their news. And if you think about it, there are only two explanations for why the administration fought so hard to prevent that information from being published. And all of them did it. New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, AP, all of them sat on this information. And the logic behind that, I can think of just two reasons. One is because Obama was going out publicly and saying, he's a diplomat. And no one in the press was correcting that, okay? So that's one reason they didn't want us to know, because then we would all know that Obama was lying to us to be able to make a stake that this guy had some claim to immunity. And then the other reason is Davis was not a CIA spy. He's a contractor and has ties to Blackwater. And to a large degree, The reason they didn't want us to know the story, I think, is because it confirmed, you know, we're going to hail Jeremy Scahill, I think, all day. But Scahill had been reporting on the contractors in Pakistan for quite some time, and CENTCOM had come out and said, oh, nonsense, you know, and this confirmed what he was saying, which is that we've got contractors in Pakistan, and, you know, all of the sensitivities that we in the United States have about the contractors, you know, shooting people in Iraq and now Pakistan, I think, they managed to avoid some of the outrage about that by not publishing this. So that's one data point. Second data point, P.J. Crowley, he's the guy who got ousted from the State Department because he said that the treatment of Bradley Manning was ridiculous, counterproductive, and stupid. Okay, P.J. Crowley was the spokesperson of the State Department until about 3 weeks ago. And at that point, he said that the treatment of Bradley Manning, who's the alleged WikiLeaks leaker, and particularly the forced nudity that the government was using with him, was ridiculous, counterproductive, and stupid. Within a couple of days, Obama was asked a question about it, and then immediately Bill Daley had made sure that Crowley was gone by the end of the week. But this is something Crowley said about social media in January. So after Tunisia, before Egypt, and it's just ripe with irony, so I wanted to read it. He said this to a class in D.C. We express concern about the plight of journalists or bloggers around the world who are intimidated, jailed, or even killed by governments that are afraid of their people and afraid of the empowerment that comes with the free flow of information within a civil society. Most recently, we did so in the context of Tunisia, which has hacked social media accounts while claiming to protect their citizens from the incitement of violence. But in doing so, we feel the government is unduly restricting the ability of its people to assemble and express their views in order to influence government policies. These are universal principles that we continue to support, and we practice what we preach. And he went on to address WikiLeaks, which I'm going to return to in just a second. But it is true that the State Department, and you actually see this in the WikiLeaks cables, it's true that the State Department does support activists. There was reporting a couple weeks ago about that they've spent $50 million for a panic button for democracy activists overseas so that they can wipe out all their address book and their phone immediately and send a warning to other activists. This is at the same time as our government is stopping people as they come, you know, stopping people like David House, who's tied to WikiLeaks, as he comes into the country and taking his laptop so that they can get all the content. You know, there's this wonderful irony. Third data point. Dianne Feinstein, bless her soul. She's wrong on most policy issues, but she has this very unique ability. If you watch her carefully, particularly in her role on the Senate Intelligence Committee, occasionally she'll admit the truth in very useful ways. And she did this in the case of social media, because she laid into the intelligence community after Egypt, because there was this, you know, in the press it was, how come you didn't tell us Egypt, you know, how come you didn't tell us Mubarak is about to be overthrown? And the intelligence community came back and said, well, you know, how are we supposed to know that a fruit vendor in Tunisia, in the Tunisian desert, was going to light himself on fire? And that's how they got out of any kind of responsibility for warning it. But what Feinstein's point was, and this is amazing and it's true and you can see it in the WikiLeaks cables as well, is that our intelligence community, at least up until January, wasn't following democracy activists on social media. Our intelligence community spends a lot of time in Al-Qaeda chat rooms, right? So they're spending a lot of time monitoring particular groups of people online. But what both the State Department and the intelligence community were completely not following, even after like the January 25th protest in Egypt, even after events in Tunisia, the Facebook event, there's this great State Department cable where they talk about the Egyptian government coming back to the State Department and saying, wow, you know, we can't get anybody to listen to our propaganda, but with this just one Facebook site, they were able to bring out X thousands of people in a protest. And so the State Department knew the power of social media as a tool, but they weren't actually following the content of it. And there's another great cable where they were talking with an April 6th activist, so somebody who went on to be really involved in the events of the last several months. And they had actually helped the April 6th movement. They had gotten their YouTube account turned back on when the Egyptian government turned it off. I mean, so they actually do support these people to some degree. But he basically said to the State Department, our goal is to overthrow Mubarak before the elections in 2011. And the State Department, it was just dripped with condescension. They're like, that's not the opinion of the mainstream people who are opposition figures in Egypt. And they basically said, there's no way on God's earth that they're going to be able to overthrow Mubarak, so we're going to continue to support him. So they were wrong. But it's this wonderful moment, I think, where the State Department, I mean, you all following Sharif know more about what's going on in Egypt than our spy community. Maybe that overstates it slightly, but that is an incredibly powerful thought that being able to follow in real time on Twitter allows both bloggers, but also just citizens to be able to say, this is what's going on the other side of the world, but our government, of course, is still going to operate under the old assumptions. So WikiLeaks, and I'm going to close with this. Let me take a show of hands. PJ Crowley said it's horrible for Tunisia's government to hack the social media sites of activists there. How many people in this room believe that the government had some role in bringing down the WikiLeaks site in early December, making it inaccessible in this country? A good many of you. There has been almost no discussion. There's been a little bit of coverage after the fact, after State Department admitted that, the WikiLeaks disclosures weren't all that terrible, but they had said so because it made it legally easier to go to PayPal and Visa and everybody else to take WikiLeaks down. So there was some legal process behind what the government did to what is essentially a media outlet, right? But we don't know what it is. And one of the really interesting things about that fact and the fact that they're stopping activists at the border and taking their laptops is that in December, Eric Holder, Attorney General Holder, said that we're conducting an espionage investigation of WikiLeaks. The Patriot Act is useful for two kinds of investigations. One is counterterrorism, so they can use it to investigate Al-Qaeda. The other one is espionage. And many of the laws in the Patriot Act basically say, for example, they can get the business records of anybody they want, so long as the Attorney General goes to a judge and says, this is for an espionage investigation. And you don't even have to be connected. They can go and get my business records if they want to. They can say, well, we think there might be, Marcy Wheeler writes a lot about Bradley Manning, so we might find something, so we're going to go get her business records. And, I don't know that they used the Patriot Act. The fact that they did this Twitter order to get the Twitter background of a bunch of activists suggests that they at least are trying to get evidence that they aren't embarrassed to admit into a court proceeding. But we don't know. And that's part of the issue, is that our government overseas is happy to give democracy activists panic switches. But they're really assaulting the notion of democracy here in this country and beginning to increasingly treating us reporting on what our own government is doing as espionage. I think that's kind of where they're going to go after the independent media as we go forward, is to go ahead and hack them, or go ahead and defund them, or go ahead and, the good news is they're no longer arresting and shooting Al Jazeera journalists the way they were several years ago, at least not as much as they did, but they're still taking this incredibly hostile view to journalists within their own country, particularly independent journalists.
Marcy Wheeler. If it weren't for conferences like this, I don't know that we'd ever get Marcy out of Michigan or out of her pajamas. Our next panel.